Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
Any general who ventures upon a battlefield without understanding the enemy is doomed to defeat. Just like a militia that forms itself upon a peninsula has already created its own concentration camp, unless it has a navy.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Just back from the eastern Ukraine this week, what does Marina Morris make of the crisis in her homeland? With Kiev in the hands of the pro-EU Ukrainians, but Sevastopol and Crimea in the hands of the pro-Russians, a tug of war, it seems to be, over the regional administrations around Ukraine, particularly in the east. So we hear from Marina on what could be the breakup of a country, or else a whole entire new country. Plus, Mohammed Al-Fayed's banned documentary about the Diana inquest, Unlawful Killing, was shot and directed by the singer Lily Allen's dad, Keith Allen, back in 2011. Only in the last few weeks has it appeared on YouTube for the first time. How long will it last there? Why was it banned? And more importantly, what does it say? And the other fundamentalism. This week saw one of the most important events in the United States political calendar, the AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C. Who are the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and what are they saying, and how are they so powerful? Plus, last weekend saw the National Conference of Positive Money in London, who have plans to kick out most of the City of London and sort out our money system once and for all. Next weekend, a similar meeting's being held here in Bristol. We start this week with Marina Morris, who's just literally this week flown back from eastern Ukraine. Hi, Marina, and welcome to the Politics Show again. Lovely to see you.
Hello, Tony. A few days ago, I returned from my native eastern Ukrainian city, Kharkov, to the UK. For the first time in my life, I can see my country occupied by foreign military forces. Putin's military intervention and brutal aggression of Ukraine threaten both my country and world peace. 4 years ago, in 2010, in Kharkov, the former pro-Russian president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, signed with his Russian counterpart, Medvedev, an agreement extending by 25 years the tenure of the Russian Navy in Sevastopol. Subsequently, opposition leaders and many Ukrainians see Yanukovych as a servant of Russian national interest, not Ukrainian. After becoming president in 2010, Yanukovych quickly concentrated power and wealth in the hands of his family, who held all the key economic positions in the government. Ukraine's new prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, said Yanukovych embezzled as much as $37 billion during his 3 years in office. Ukraine's gold reserves are falling fast. According to the World Bank, when Yanukovych came to power in February 2010, they were around $26.5 billion. Just in November 2013, they fell by $1.8 billion. They are now believed to be around $15 billion, compared to the national debts of around $130 billion. The shortfall of $115 billion is around $2,500 per head of population. Finally, the mass will of Ukrainians deposed the corrupted, unpopular regime of Yanukovych and his family, and lots of former Eastern supporters from his native city Donetsk also lost trust in him and now call him a traitor. Many Ukrainians gave their lives for freedom and genuine democracy. United Eastern and Western Ukrainians choose a pro-Western future. Putin, as a dominating economic and political partner, sees the recent power change as a direct threat to Russian national security and uses all his repertoire to provoke future conflict, create tensions, clashes. He tells lies and uses propaganda in attempt to restore a discredited and rejected political regime responsible for national bankruptcy, economic chaos in the country, and shooting its own citizen on the street of its capital. Putin is exploiting his politically bankrupt puppet Yanukovych, which with the aim of pulling Crimea away from Ukraine and a final mission to block the country from joining the European Union. This is an opinion shared by lots of Ukrainian political analysts. Putin lies to his own population. He claims his troops only seek to protect people of Russian origin. All Ukrainians are of Russian origin, even nationalists. Ukraine's main conflict is this regime of Yanukovych, not between pro-Russian or pro-Western supporters. I am ethnically Russian. There is no threat to Russian people in eastern Ukraine and Crimea other than from Russian itself. In contrast, the Kremlin's troops camped on the border of my Kharkov create only economic chaos, psychological pressure, and destroy the historically friendship between neighbors. Most people to whom I spoke have similar views. Crimea. There are lots of different groups in Ukraine who don't support the new government and want to split and destabilize the country. They are supporting Putin's scenario of unconstitutional referendum in Crimea on the 16th of March. Putin is acting through the so-called local defense forces in Crimea and eastern part of Ukraine. Their actions have no legal ground, and their views pose a very big danger to the sovereignty of Ukraine and a stable Europe. Article 73 of the Constitution of Ukraine states, alteration to the territory of Ukraine shall be resolved exclusively by the all Ukrainians referendum. According to 2001 Ukrainian census, the population of Crimea is 2 million. Russians 58%, Ukrainians 24%, Crimean Tatars 12%. Crimean residents who consider Ukraine their motherland is 71%. Around 30% of Crimean's residents claims to have retained a self-identified Soviet identity. Ukraine cannot prevent annexation by itself and desperately needs help from European partners. Russia committed illegal actions and started a crisis not only in Ukraine, but also in Europe. An emergency European Union summit in Brussels is unlikely to adopt more than symbolic measure against Russia, Europe's biggest gas supplier. The United States said it is ready to impose sanctions such as visa bans, asset freezes on individual Russian officials, and restriction on business ties within days rather than weeks. There can never be a solution. It is unacceptable and immoral behavior for a stable Europe and modern world. In 1994, in the Budapest Memorandum, Ukraine handed over its nuclear weapons to Russia. In return, Russia guaranteed Ukraine's territorial integrity. 20 years later, in 2014, the Kremlin invaded Ukraine instead of protecting it, thereby violating international agreements and norms. United Western and Eastern Ukrainians want to avoid war, protect territorial integrity, restore stability, and live in a country free from corruption. Most people that I spoke to support the new government, and this is in Kharkov, which is historically pro-Russian area. Putin's actions are losing people's support. Again, I want to repeat, I am ethnically Russian. I don't want to see relations with Russia through soldiers and tanks. We are brothers and sisters. I want peace. I want friendship and holidays in my sovereign country by the Black Sea.
Just one question I hope you don't mind me asking, Marina. I mean, one of the things you mentioned there was Russian troops near Kharkov. Did you actually see that for yourself, and could you identify those troops as definitely Russian?
I haven't seen by myself, but my son have seen a Russian vehicle near this border of city.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your report. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we're hearing also that the regions in eastern Ukraine, that the parliaments are having their legitimacy questioned, rallies being held outside them. In Kharkov, for example, there was a takeover by pro-Russians of the administrative building in that region of Ukraine, and then again today they've been thrown out by the police. So can you just tell us what you think? I mean, we'll be talking about Sevastopol and Crimea in a minute, but what do you think about the eastern regions of Ukraine and what's going to happen there? Because we were quite clearly in a situation where there may be some kind of backlash by the minority Russians against the Kiev government.
Well, I mean, I hear what Marina is saying, that in Kharkov...
Can you just answer my question
What is the question?
The question is about what you think is going to be happening in the eastern regions of Ukraine. We've seen in Donetsk, example, and Kharkov...
I was going to answer that question.
The competition, really, for the administrative buildings in those regions.
Yeah, well, that's what happened in Lviv, in the west of the Ukraine. The far-right party seized the offices of the local authority in Lviv and declared independence from Kiev when Yanukovych was still the president. So there's a potential for secessionism at both ends of the Ukraine. And this situation reminds me a bit of the situation in Yugoslavia some years ago in the 1990s. I think it's quite interesting. I mean, I don't know what the opinions of people in Kharkov are. It's not for me to say. I mean, I can hear what Marina is saying. If this is the case, that most people in Kharkov want to be united with Ukraine, well, that will play itself out. But it's clearly the case in Crimea. They're going to have a vote next week on independence. Now, it looks as if the pro-Russians will win that. Maybe they won't. But if they do, they'll say it's not constitutional. But when Slovenia declared independence of Yugoslavia, that wasn't constitutional. When Croatia declared independence of Yugoslavia, that wasn't constitutional. When Bosnia declared independence of Yugoslavia, that wasn't constitutional. When Kosovo declared independence of Yugoslavia, that wasn't constitutional either under the existing Yugoslav constitution. But at the time, because pro-Western regimes were coming to power in each of these countries, the West supported that. And in fact, the Germans recognised the Croatians when they shouldn't really have done so, according to the British Foreign Office. So these kind of games can be played. Okay. They've been played in South Ossetia and Georgia as well.
Looking at the democratic side of it, and we've heard very clearly from Marina there that he was elected in 2010, but there's been a lot of corruption around the family of Yanukovych, the president. Having said that, there were parliamentary elections actually less than a year before the demonstrations started in Kiev. Maybe you could just explain, you know, we're in a situation where the party of the regions won the largest majority in that election, which was actually very recent. If we just ignore Yanukovych, the presidency, for a minute.
Well, what seems to have happened is some of the party of the regions deputies have switched sides, which they're absolutely entitled to do. But the problem is, two things really, is that a lot of the deputies were forced out at gunpoint from the Rada and disappeared to the eastern Ukraine, so they didn't get to vote. And also, as we heard in this telephone intercept by the Ukrainian secret services of the discussion between Catherine Ashton and the foreign minister of Estonia.
Well, just a minute. First of all, it wasn't really a discussion. It was the foreign minister of Estonia speaking, and Catherine Ashton going.
He was briefing her. Briefing her.
Wasn't much of a conversation.
He was briefing her that what he understood from talking to people on the ground is that the shootings were carried out by snipers linked to one of the two far-right parties in the Rada. Now, these far-right parties in the Rada are very far-right parties. Yatsenyuk is a liberal, but the Svoboda Party and the Right Sector Party are neo-Nazis.
Let's just consider for a minute the possibility that could be correct. We did hear last week that this is before this all kicked off, before Yanukovych was kicked out of the country, that British rifles were being used by the snipers in Kiev, which is in itself is rather shocking and worrying. But is there any kind of precedent for NATO and the Western powers using these sorts of tactics?
Yes. I mean, at the beginning of the uprising in Syria, you had a popular demonstrations going on, and then what started happening is snipers were shooting both police and demonstrators. It happened also in Venezuela during the coup there. Now, these things are part of a NATO destabilization playbook, and the Russian secret services will be very familiar with how this stuff works. They've got this telephone intercept. This telephone intercept is going to undermine this new government in Kiev completely, because they don't forget that the fascist parties have taken control of the police.
Well, I don't think you can say that, Martin, because the information contained in that intercept has not been proven.
Okay.
Anyway, let's move to another angle on this, because China is also a very important player in all this, and particularly at the Security Council of the United Nations. Chinese newspaper has actually slammed the West's Cold War mentality over Ukraine. This is Reuters from Beijing just at the end of last week. China's top newspaper criticised the West on Thursday for remaining locked in a Cold War mentality against Russia in the contest for influence over Ukraine, calling for the shackles of such outmoded thinking to be cast off to deal with the crisis. The comment, published in the People's Daily, flagship newspaper of the ruling Communist Party, was the strongest reaction yet in Beijing to the rift between the West and Russia that's been growing since the ouster of Moscow's ally Viktor Yanukovych following weeks of protests. Now, do you think really that the Chinese, I mean, this does seem to be something which is between the greater powers of the United States, the EU and Russia. Are the Chinese really going to have much of a say here?
Well, the important thing is Sergei Glazyev, who is Putin's advisor, he said that if you do decide to go for sanctions on Russia about what's happening, we are going to crash the dollar, and we're going to do it with our Chinese friends. We're going to dump our dollars. We're going to crash the US economy, and that's what we're going to do if you try and put sanctions on us. Which is why, of course, the British government, the advice they were being given by their top advisors, is we can't put sanctions on the Russians. That they will crash the world economy, and they will.
Okay, another side of it all is that the Americans are very, very much more gung-ho for some sort of intervention, stronger measures against the Russians than the EU seem to be. The EU seem to be wanting to at least, you know, have some sort of nice negotiations with the Russians rather than economic sanctions and this kind of thing. So let's go now to Senator McCain. He's a Republican senator. He was also, I believe, a presidential candidate at one time, wasn't he? A couple of elections ago. And see what he had to say about it all. And this took place in Washington, D.C. Monday this week. McCain was speaking at the APAC conference. That is the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And here he is.
I really do come to you this morning with a heavy heart, with a heavy heart and great sadness because of the events that are taking place in Ukraine. And what happens in Ukraine is directly related to what happens in the Middle East, and obviously we know that what happens in the Middle East is vital to the existence of the State of Israel. I'm not going to go through the history of Ukraine with you, but the fact is Crimea is a sovereign part of the sovereign nation of Ukraine. And the people of Ukraine, by the hundreds of thousands, went to a square in sub-freezing weather that saying that they did not want to be part of Putin's Russia. And that's what it was all about. And now that the Olympics are over, immediately afterwards, we now see the occupation of Crimea. And by the way, in case you missed it, one of the reasons why there's a majority population of Russians in Crimea is because Stalin exported all the Tartars. Over half of them were killed as he deported them from the Crimea. But the fact is that this is a blatant act on the part of Vladimir Putin, and one that must be unacceptable to the world community. It cannot stand. And I have to be very honest with you, there is not a military option that could be exercised now, but the most powerful and biggest and strongest nation in the world should have plenty of options. And those options are many, ranging from identifying these kleptocrats, these corruption people, and the people that ordered this, and the Magnitsky Act. Thank God for the Magnitsky Act, we could expand it and identify those people, and it would be their last trip to Las Vegas. So we can enact economic sanctions. We can, there's a broad array of options that we have. Why do we care? because this is the ultimate result of a feckless foreign policy where nobody believes in America's strength anymore.
Well, he's talking to the gallery there for a US audience. He said one sensible thing there: there is no military option. He's right about that. There isn't.
Well, we've heard, actually, Martin, just yesterday that Turkey has granted a US warship permission to enter the Black Sea. So, I mean, clearly the Americans are thinking about some possibility of maybe naval conflict in the Black Sea.
Well, hopefully not. I mean, I'm sure there are differences of opinion in Ukraine, and there's a real question about whether Crimea was only put in Ukraine in 1954 when Khrushchev was drunk because he was a Ukrainian, and in actual fact it's never historically been part of Ukraine until the 1950s. So we're now, just as what happened in Yugoslavia, Kosovo was made an autonomous region of Serbia by Tito in the late 70s. So we then argue about borders that have been drawn up by some previous communist dictator.
But what about what McCain's saying there? This decision for the Russian troops to go into Crimea cannot stand.
Well, he can say that as much as he likes. It will stand, and hopefully the government in Kiev is not... They can oppose... I've got no objection to people opposing other people doing things. The government in Kiev say, we're not happy with this. But the people in the Crimea will say, well, we're not happy, we're going to go our own way. But what's really important here is that no violence is used in settling these disputes. That's, everybody's got an interest in settling disputes without force. And I don't think that this idea that the Russians have invaded Crimea, they're entitled to have up to 25,000 troops in Crimea at any one time. They haven't brought any extra troops in. They've just deployed them around the place. And the Crimean parliament voted yesterday to have a referendum in 10 days' time on independence from Ukraine, well, or more autonomy within
NATO
Ukraine.
NATO have said they want all those Russian troops confined to their bases.
Well, they're not going to be confined to their bases. But what McCain, let's come back to what McCain is talking about. We can start putting sanctions on Russia. I would say that, first of all, you should talk to the Russians before you do that. And don't forget that sanctions on Russia, the Russians will retaliate. And with their allies, the Chinese, who are holding the US national debt, it could be a bit of a serious negotiation, couldn't it?
What about what McCain was also saying about connections with the Middle East and Israel? He seems to make some very strong links between what's going on in the Ukraine and weakness, as he says it, sees it, of the West in Ukraine, and how that will be interpreted in the Middle East as weakness over Iran and Syria.
This is just macho bully talk. Politicians shouldn't talk like that. We've got to be seen to be strong. We've got to hit these people hard and know that we're going to hit them and all the rest of it. It's 19th century talk. In actual fact, most problems in the world can be resolved, but you have to have an even balanced kind of view of it. If we start seeing Russia as an enemy, they will be an enemy. But there's no reason for Russia to be an enemy of Ukraine or for us to be enemies of each other. And of course, the Putin's support inside Russia is overwhelming. He's got 70-80% support in the opinion polls, and the Russian Duma gave him a... nobody in the Duma voted against Putin's policy. Nobody. Not even one.
Are you talking about his policy where he said he wanted to be able to take troops into Ukraine?
Well, they gave him a blank check to do what he thought was necessary and right. So that you've got to remember, I mean, I realise that this is very controversial inside Ukraine, and there's a big spread of opinions inside Ukraine, because the Communist Party got about 18 to 20% of the vote, mostly Eastern Ukrainians, and you've got these far-right parties who are very, very far-right parties who are part of this new government. And of course, the suspicion is that it's their snipers which actually killed the protesters.
But can you understand what Marina was saying there, how nervous people in Kharkov are, and Donetsk too, about Russian troops, actually coming close to their city?
Absolutely. I should imagine everybody in Ukraine, don't forget the economy in Ukraine is not in a good state. People have been struggling for years. And part of the policy, the economic policy, which is going to be pursued by the new government, the IMF have come in, they say, what you've got to do, first of all, you've got to cut pensions by 50%. I was reading that this morning. So the new government is going to cut all pensions by 50%. That's part of the deal to get IMF bailout money. But of course, ultimately, what we're talking about here is shock therapy for Ukraine. Ukraine hasn't had shock therapy. Russia had shock therapy in the 90s under Yeltsin. Ukraine basically didn't do it, and quite wisely in my view, because shock therapy tends to create shocks, and that's the problem with it. In my view, you need a more gradual, balanced economic policy.
Okay, back to the AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C. Monday this week. Senator, Republican candidate for President John McCain and former torture victim from North Vietnam was speaking, and a little bit later in the talk, he mentioned Iran and Syria and the implications for them.
In 2009, many of you may remember, as we saw on YouTube, we saw a young woman named Netta bleed to death in the street in Tehran when the people of Iran rose up and said, "Obama, Obama, are you with us or are you with us or are you with them?" And you know what? The President of the United States didn't say a word. The President of the United States believes that the Cold War is over. That's fine. It is over. But Putin doesn't believe it's over. He doesn't believe that that this is a zero-sum game. Look at Moldova. Look at the occupation of Georgia. Look at the pressure on the Baltic nations. Look at what they're doing in assisting Bashar Assad slaughter tens of thousands of innocent people in cities and towns and countryside all over Syria. It is an outrage. And these people, and Vladimir Putin, while he is cooperating with us in the removal of chemical weapons, plane load after plane load of regular weapons, of artillery, of rockets, of tanks, are landing at the airport in Damascus, slaughtering innocent people. And I will tell you, it's hard for a mother to differentiate whether their child has been killed by a chemical weapon or one of these horrible barrel bombs that are basically cluster bombs that are being dropped on innocent civilians all over Syria. And we have watched, sat by and watched it happen. And if Bashar Assad prevails, it will directly endanger the security of the state of Israel. And this is now turned into a regional conflict. Lebanon is destabilized. What do you think those 5,000 Hezbollah fighters are going to be like when they return from the fighting in Syria to southern Lebanon? What do you think is going to happen if Bashar Assad continues to prevail as far as the other nations in the region are concerned? Jordan, probably our best friend, is destabilized. The whole situation cries out for American leadership, and I'm sorry to tell you, it's MIA.
Of course, by MIA there, he means missing in action, Martin, and he's really bemoaning the lack of action by the Americans in the Middle East, particularly Syria and Iran.
Well, he's having a go at Obama, basically, saying Obama's weak, Obama's, you know, he's not manly enough, he's not doing enough macho stuff. I mean, that sort of talk reminds me of the word chauvinism. We use the word chauvinism in English. It actually comes from a French minister from the 19th century called Chauvin, and he was always calling for war, always calling for war. So chauvinism became associated with this particular politician. And I'm afraid Mr. McCain is the Monsieur Chauvin of our day. He never saw a war he didn't like.
Well, I mean,
it's just macho stuff.
Martin, he's had far more experience of war than you have, for example, because he was in Vietnam, wasn't he? He was captured as a prisoner by the North Vietnamese.
Yes, and of course, what he was actually doing in Vietnam was bombing civilians from 30,000 feet, and the North Vietnamese shot him down. It's a pity they didn't kill him, eh?
Well, no, that's not the case. I mean, because he's here now as a politician, he's putting his points of view. He's got every right to.
No, but during the Vietnam War, I would have supported the North Vietnamese shooting him down. They should have killed him. Never mind. You know, I'm just sorry. He's the guy who talks about war, and of course, when he was actually in the prison camps, people who were in the prison camps with him say that in actual fact he cooperated with the North Vietnamese. So all this stuff about what a hero he was is a load of rubbish. And don't forget, what he was doing in Vietnam was bombing civilians in North Vietnam. He's personally got masses of blood on his hands.
So, well, I mean, how does this all link up with what we're listening to now, which is the little snapshot into that APAC conference at Washington on Monday?
Well, you mentioned what APAC is earlier, and we need to actually unpack that a bit. It's the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, massively, massively powerful. They basically vet all candidates for Congress and Senate.
Oh, they can't do that from Israel.
Oh, yes, they can.
No, they can't.
They've got massive amounts of money. The Israeli government gives them massive amounts of money. They've got plenty of wealthy friends as well.
Which doesn't a lot of that come from the US government?
No, in actual fact, it's a very odd situation because in theory, foreign governments are not supposed to pay to influence elections in the US. Of course, the US paid $5 billion in the last 5 years alone to support their proteges in Ukraine. And foreign countries are not supposed to. But of course, APEC is funded by the Israeli government, and it basically tries to determine US policy, and McCain is there sucking
up. But the Israelis have got every right to do that. For example, they have Labour friends of Israel, conservative friends of Israel in this country.
The legitimate political positions are there.
They're lobbying.
But AIPAC is an extremely important, very important organisation. They make or break US politicians, and that's why Israel, in fact, basically gets. I mean, the Israelis stole the US's nuclear secrets in the 1980s and sold them on to the Russians. And that's the sort of thing they do. And many people inside the US armed forces are very well aware of Israel's kind of Trojan horse infiltration of security and politics in their country.
Okay, back to the APEC conference and John McCain again. This time he's talking towards the end of his speech about Iran.
I believe we have to keep the pressure on. Iran's rulers must know that the only alternative to compromising on our terms is even more crippling sanctions or worse. And that's why I believe the Senate should pass new bipartisan sanctions legislation that would take effect if the current negotiations don't succeed. We must stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapons capability, and we must do so because of the nature of the threat posed by this Iranian regime. It's not an arms control challenge. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard is in Syria slaughtering people today. They are training these extremists, and they will not quit. This regime in Iran is the world's leading sponsor of terror. It has murdered Americans, Israelis, and Jews across the globe. It is categorically devoted to the destruction of the State of Israel. It is training and arming militant groups across the Middle East. It's destabilizing its neighbors and meddling in their affairs. It's developing sophisticated ballistic weapon missiles, including ICBMs that could target America, and more than any foreign actor, the blood of Syria. When a president of the United States says that president's going to take military action and does not, that sends a message all the way around the globe is about us. You did the right thing, and I commend you for it. You know, a lot of my fellow countrymen say, we're weary of war. We want to get out. I hear this phrase over and over again. There'll never be another land war which the United States engages in. Do you know how many times in history that's been said? Do you know how many times prior to World War II, when Hitler marched into the Sudetenland, and when Neville Chamberlain said, we're not going to fight in a faraway country for people that don't speak our language and we don't know? My friends, the lessons of history are that we have to be ready. And as Ronald Reagan used to say, peace through strength, not through weakness, and not through cutting our defense budget back to the smallest army than we've had since prior to World War II.
Martin, John McCain there, Republican, speaking at the APAC conference, America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, on Monday, about international affairs of all sorts, Ukraine particularly. What he's saying there about Iran is pretty clear, isn't it? This is a very terroristic country, one of the biggest in the world, arming all sorts of gangs around the Middle East. And he's also saying they're developing intercontinental ballistic missiles which could target the US. Now, he's very worried about their nuclear program and whether they may develop nuclear weapons.
Well, I mean, this is a long-running saga, isn't it? What's very interesting is how McCain is telling his audience what they want to hear. So when he says he wants sanctions on Iran, they're all cheering. Now, in actual fact, Obama, to his credit, is trying to negotiate with the Iranians, which is what most ordinary people around the world want, actually. Rouhani has just been elected in Iran, and he was elected by a majority. He is the leader, perfectly legitimately. It's not a free society, Iran. Not a free society. They've got political prisoners, and it's not an entirely free society, but he was freely elected. And they have far more elections in Iran than they do in our ally, Saudi Arabia. When did they last have an election in Saudi Arabia? Remind me. The hypocrisy, the stinking hypocrisy of people on the Republican Party, like McCain, going on about the way they go on. The invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan have cost millions of civilian lives, and the kind of talk he's coming out with is belligerent, thoughtless. He's like a tank. But of course, they haven't been able to attack Iran and Syria or Russia, because in actual fact, the United States hasn't won a war not a proper one, since 1945. They've basically got their backside kicked every time by the North Vietnamese, by the Afghan resistance. They've never won anything. But that doesn't matter to the people who are selling weaponry. It's not
Martin,
about winning.
Can we just go back to Syria and look at the intervention by the Russians to shoot down some missiles which were heading for Syria? I know you think that this is something that McCain seems to think is good, having a strong military attitude towards Syria, places like that. He certainly wanted a strike. The Israelis wanted a strike too. And yet the Russians actually used their base, didn't they, in the Black Sea as a base for operations in the Eastern Mediterranean, which it looks like blocked those missiles last summer from actually hitting Damascus.
Well, what the Russians and Chinese general staffs have been developing is anti-ship missiles. They realise that they can't compete with the West.
But what I'm talking about here is actually anti-missile missiles, because these look like two cruise missiles which were heading for Syria, which were shot down.
Well, that's all very mysterious.
It
was the Israelis who fired them, and they said that they were firing them, test firing them. There was a face-off going on between the Western navies and the Russian navy in the Eastern Mediterranean. These missiles are then fired by the Israelis, or supposedly, nobody's quite sure, and then and the Israelis said, well, we're just having a little test. And I think the Western admirals weren't very happy about it, because, of course, it basically complicated the situation enormously. Now, those missiles then were shot down. Now, we're not quite sure who shot the missiles down. They might have been shot down by the Russians. They might have been shot down by the Americans, because they don't want the Israelis starting the war for them. Now, this is how dangerous and hair-trigger all of this stuff is.
And just relate it to Sevastopol and the Crimea, because that's where that Russian fleet is based, isn't it?
Of course, it was the
Russians that shot.
Which is why the Russians are not going to, in no way, Jose, are they going to give that up? Because that fleet, and the if you remember Gallipoli in the First World War, we haven't done our history of the First World War this week, but that was the key. The Dardanelles is a key. We've been fighting over the Dardanelles ever since the Trojan War. It's a key place. And, of course, we're still fighting over it.
OK, back to AIPAC, though. There was... I've got a clip now from an Orthodox rabbi. And what they're doing is they're basically saying that the various different types of Judaism, Orthodox, Reform and Conservative, are all united for Israel.
There's a whole spread of opinion amongst Jews. A whole spread of opinion. You can't say the Jews think this or the Jews think that. Well, in actual fact, most Jews in America vote Democratic, and many of them are opposed to war. But the Australian, I keep calling it the Australian, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee is made up of wealthy Jews, and their voices count, the ones with the money. Lots of ordinary working class Jews don't actually agree with their policies at all.
Okay, so now let's listen to a New York Orthodox rabbi. His name's Stephen Weil. He was also talking at the AIPAC conference.
I'm an Orthodox rabbi who grew up in part of upstate New York that had many more cows than Jews. No joke. At least it seemed that way to me. My parents are German Jewish refugees in the cattle business, and we had dairy farms. And my earliest memory associated with Israel was from my father. He encouraged our neighbors, our clients, who were mainly Methodist, Baptist, Lutheran, to buy Israel bonds. And he said it would be the greatest investment for themselves and for the Jewish state. I went to study at a yeshiva in Israel when I was 18. The year was 1982. Israel was at war with terrorists in Lebanon, and one by one, my new Israeli friends and their classmates, they were called up to serve. And when one, and then another, and still others died defending our collective right to safely live in the Jewish state, I gained a very different understanding of what patriotism is, of service, and of the precious nature of Israel and life itself. And we stand today as colleagues and good friends. But not just that. We stand together united in our common love for Kol Yisrael, all of Israel. We stand together in recognition of our precious tiny homeland and the fulfillment of Isaiah's ancient dream that the nation of Israel would one day become a light unto the nations, an Or LaGoyim, a bastion of decency, of freedom and hope.
Martin, there's a New York Orthodox rabbi. They're talking about Isaiah's dream, a beacon of hope that Israel can be.
Well, the thing that I noticed, he's talking about Lebanon in 1982, fighting terrorists, as he put it. Something between 30 and 40,000 civilians were killed by the by that fighting. A friend of mine, a Palestinian woman, was Dima. She was actually in an air raid shelter in Beirut when it was hit by an Israeli phosphorus bomb. And she said it was absolutely horrifying because the bomb hit the doorway of the shelter. You got several hundred people in the shelter. And then these people started burning to death. And as they touched people next to them, they would start burning to death. And she said, I was on the far side of the shelter and I could see this white phosphorus burning coming across the shelter towards me. In actual fact, it never got there. But that is what defending Israel is about. It's basically wrecking Lebanon. Lebanon's been reduced to complete mess by the Israelis over the years. And of course, they don't just mind their own business. If they just sat there and minded their own business, there wouldn't be a problem. But just like the British and the Americans, they can't resist poking around with sticks in dark holes.
But I mean, if you look online at Jews and Zionism, for example, you see actually the vast majority of these Orthodox Jews seem to be very against Zionism. There's several websites. How representative is he of
Jews? As I said earlier, there's a huge spread of Jewish opinion.
I mean, we've got an organisation called Literary Carter,
there isn't just a Jewish point of view. What you've got is lots of different opinions. I mean, what you've got in Israel and many other countries, you've got a belligerent right, far right. I mean, what's very bizarre in the Ukraine is Yatsenyuk is Jewish, who's the new president, but in his coalition, he's got neo-Nazis running the police force and the security services. And they are neo-Nazis. If you look at their stuff, it's a Jewish-Russian, a Russian-Yid conspiracy that they go on about. So it's very bizarre. I mean, the world is full of contradiction. Some Orthodox people are very hostile to the State of Israel, some aren't. Some secular Jews are very supportive of the State of Israel, some aren't.
So you can't
generalise.
Orthodox, Reform and Conservative, Judaism, all united for Israel, is that a bit of spin?
It's a bit of spin, because you'll actually find that you've got... what's happening at the moment, the Haredi Jews in Israel do not have to serve in the armed forces. They go into what they call yeshivas instead, which is what one of these guys went to. And the Israeli secular government is now saying, well, your boys are going to have to serve in the armed forces. And they don't want to, because many of the Orthodox Jews don't believe in the physical existence of the State of Israel. They think it's a blasphemy. And they actually live, really, literally, in their minds. And they spend a lot of time reading the Bible. And that's what they do. And they don't, and they're actually hostile to serving in the army, and they don't believe in the State of Israel at all.
He's citing Isaiah there. I mean, it does sound like a kind of fundamentalism. It's a belief, a biblical so-called belief, that Israel is there.
This is the problem.
It's God's kingdom on earth.
We're not talking rationally, where people say we've got to have this land because God gave it to us. It's quite difficult to argue with that, isn't it? But of course, once we've had a democratic election in Saudi Arabia, we'll find out who owns that land, won't we? Put it.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, last weekend saw the National Conference of Positive Money, and there's also a conference, a seminar taking place next weekend here in Bristol on a similar topic. And I'm joined now by Tim Malnick, who's one of the organisers. Hi, Tim.
Hello there. Hi, Tony.
Can you just tell us what's happening next weekend?
Yeah, just to be clear, it's not a positive money event, although I think their work is very interesting and I know a bit about it. This is a local community event, and it's really a drop-in community event to inform people about a range of things, either Bristol-based or that they can connect to in Bristol, all of which are pointing towards different ways that local people can think around issues of money, community, and really using money in service of their values, really. So we're calling it Your Money and Your Life.
Okay, it sounds like a highwayman's threat.
Well, it's not all your life, it's and your life, and that's really the key.
Okay, who's coming?
In terms of organisations, so, I mean, what we hope is local people will come. So it's being held in St Michael's Church Hall, so that's on Gloucester Road, and it's by a small Saturday market. It's on a Saturday afternoon on the 15th of March.
Can you just tell us where on Gloucester Road that is? Because it's a long road.
Yeah, okay. So if you drive up Gloucester Road, it's the bit where it starts to get more hilly after the traffic lights and the big garage that marks the sort of Somerville Barclay Road bit as you carry on going further up. So a lot of people feel that's quite quite far up north, but that's where I live. It's on a place called Pigsty Hill, so quite near the Anchor Pub, some people would know, or a fairly big co-op.
Okay, is it on
there.
The right or the left?
It's on the left, and as you drive up, you'll see a small little market outside selling burgers and food and local bread and things like that.
Well, tell us about you, Tim. What's your background?
Well, my background is fundamentally, I'm an educator, so I have been an activist and I work
a teacher?
In a field.
Have you been a teacher? Well, you're a trained teacher?
I call myself an educator more than teacher, because what I'm interested in is, rather than sort of talking at people, which is what a lot of teachers I think do, and being the expert, I do a lot of facilitation, and I guess I create educational processes for people. So I run a master's program on sustainability. I run workshops either for organizations, both commercial and not-for-profit. And my work is about engaging people, whether it's in communities or organizations or businesses, about pausing, thinking a bit more deeply about the state of the world and how their livelihoods and their organisations can actually respond to that.
Now, I know you're looking at the psychology of money. Now, that sounds to me pretty deep. I can remember as a youngster, the first time I actually ever had to buy something with money, I found the whole affair rather strange, dirty. I must have been, I don't know, about
seven or eight years old.
You know, and it was just like, do I really want to do this? And I felt like I was getting into something, even as a very young child, that I didn't really want to.
Well, one of my trainings is, it's not as an economist, although I am trying to skill myself up and learn, but my background is in psychology and organisational psychology. And as I have worked with people in all sorts of levels and organisations about change, my interest is, how do we change things? And very often money gets in the way. So people might have good ideas, they might have sound policies, we might have technology to make things more sustainable, and time again money gets in the way.
All the time, aren't you? There's not enough money for that.
Well, you hear all sorts of stories, and you just use one, Tony, just very, you know, the word came at seven, it seemed dirty. So it's quite interesting that there's what you find in mainstream economics at the moment, and the only sort of language that we hear policymakers talk about, is absolutely as if it is some mathematical science that you can rationally decide and use statistics to decide the best things to do. And there's very little acknowledgement that, yes, that's one part of it, but what money does to us actually individually and culturally is quite deep, and most of us don't know what money does to us.
Well, it's one thing is its values, isn't it? It's to do with the way we're making judgments, value judgments about things. I mean, certainly, you know, I try and always make two judgments. One is this right or wrong, and then also, can I afford it? You know, but in our psychology, am I right in saying, well, actually, what we're doing is quite often doing a shortcut and saying, well, am I going to make money out of this or not, rather than making a value
judgment? I think it's even more complex than that. I mean, just to say, at the event, we're not going to get heavy in psychology, right? So the event should just be fun. We've got lots of local organisations like Bristol Pound. We've got Move Your Money, so people can come and engage, and it will be fun. We might do a bit of making money, and we might do a bit of exploring with people, what does money mean for you? And that's where we get into these different words. I mean, you find some organisations actually don't want to make money, and they're rather afraid of making money. And for them, the psychology might be money is evil, money is dirty, money is bad. So other organisations might, or individuals in them, you know, maybe CEOs are driven by money is power, money is status. So actually the psychological stuff we have around money can drive our behaviour, and that's one of the things I'm interested in.
Will you be looking at, I mean, one of the things that's a bit of a bugbear of mine at the moment is these little, all of our cards, our credit cards, debit cards, everything's sort of going electronic, isn't it, into these little chips in a card. The way that those have slowly, over the last, I suppose, year or so, all of our credit cards have got these little symbols on them now, pretty much, with a dot and little waves coming out of them, so they're contactless payment cards. What I'm saying here, I suppose, is the way that we use money, whether it's chip and pin, signing for something, has also, we're not actually given any kind of, there's no public debate, the banks just tell us, you're doing this, boys and girls. And isn't there something there that, you know, actually, it's almost like this is something which is completely out of political debate, political discussion. The banks are just telling us, you're going to do this, folks.
Well, I think there's a lot of points there. So if I try and sort of tackle them one by one. For me, the technology of money is neutral, right? Any of these things could be used in very positive ways or in less positive ways. So, for example, the Bristol Pound use, you know, some of the most advanced technology so you can pay by through your mobile phone. So I would say technology in itself can be very positive.
Yeah, but it's not neutral, surely. I mean, if it's cash, it's something that you definitely know is being handed from one person to another. Mm-hmm. If you're using some sort of electronic transfer technology, mm-hmm. whatever, mm-hmm. somebody else is actually almost in between you
could
and the person you're transacting with.
Well, I mean,
there's a power relationship there, you know.
In terms of where that data goes and who might have access. Yeah, so I would say the technology is neutral. It's how it's used, and if you like, the political context in which that's used and the power dynamics, that's what might make it useful or not. So if you know, for example, that the Bristol Pound and the Bristol Credit Union have access and they're using it towards certain ends which you agree with and that's all transparent, you might feel fine about that. If you think that, you know, large corporate banks are using your data and you don't know what they're doing with that, then of course you feel, you know, less happy with that. In terms of we don't get any say in it, I agree. And one of my interests in this event is that I think we get very little say in anything really to do with the current financial system.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm interested in two things. There's something about economics itself which is sometimes described as like a sort of a mysticism or some sort of dark art. There's something about the language of economics which stops most normal people engaging, even though they know in terms of quality of life and, if you like, in their guts and their hearts, they know what real well-being is. They know the direction they want their communities to go. But somehow they feel they can't participate in the economic debate. And I'm very interested in engaging people coming along, even in a small way, to think, yeah, cool, there are all these amazing projects going on. I could take a little bit of time to sign up, put my money in a bank whose values I agree with. And I think that can be quite empowering for people to think that as citizens we can shape, even in a small way, the economic story that's going on.
How are we going to fix the system then? I know it's a big question. I mean, we spent probably the last 3 years trying to demystify some of this economic language,
right.
But how are we going to change it for the positive, in a nutshell?
Okay, that's a big question for a nutshell. I think that it's going to happen at all levels. So one of the ideas of change, I don't think it's ever one intervention. Change is a complex social process. So you need policymakers influenced by projects like Positive Money and Ben Dyson, who are doing amazing things to really unpick the idea about money creation. So you need clever people thinking about monetary reform, but you also need local people to come and engage and do what they can to inspire themselves around their money.
Okay, just remind us where and when it's on again.
Yeah, so it's Saturday, 15th of March, 2 till 5 p.m. Come and drop in, and it's on Gloucester Road on Pigsty Hill.
Okay, Tim Melnick, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks,
on
Tony.
The Baltic Show.
Cheers.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Finally, let's have a listen to Keith Allen's film, which is called Unlawful Killing, back on YouTube. And I'll be putting a link up to it on this show's website, which is thisweek.org.uk, after the show.
There was a powerful reason why the secret services of Britain, France, and America might have wanted Diana dead. It was Diana's involvement in the campaign to ban landmines. In the 1990s, some 85 million mines lay in wait in 62 countries. 2,000 people were being maimed or killed by them every month. A worldwide movement to ban anti-personnel landmines gathered speed during 1996. To everyone's surprise, even the world's most powerful politician was sympathetic to the ban.
To end this carnage, the United States will seek a worldwide agreement as soon as possible to end the use of all anti-personnel landmines.
Diana, Princess of Wales, took up the cause with a vengeance. In January 1997, she visited Angola, resulting in the greatest photo opportunity that the landmine campaign had ever had.
One down.
Firing.
Her involvement caused huge anger amongst governments. In Britain, Government Defence Minister Earl Howe denounced her.
Two newspapers this morning quoting unnamed ministers described as a loose cannon.
This is an important
sophisticated argument, and it doesn't help simply to point at the amputees and say how terrible it is. I very much regret that because of her position she gets so much publicity for it.
Simone Simmons was with Diana in February 1997 when a government defence minister made a threatening phone call warning the princess to end her involvement with the campaign, otherwise accidents could happen.
We were sitting down having tea one day, and the phone went in her little lounge, and she picked it up and then called me over, and there was a voice that was in the middle of conversation saying, "Don't meddle in things you know nothing about. Accidents can happen." She went a bit pale. She took it as a threat, and she said that was Nicholas Soames.
Well, fascinating. Nicholas Soames, yes. Grandson of Winston Churchill, a bastion of the establishment, here accused, hearsay perhaps, of making a phone call, threatening phone call to Diana. Was she just a headache, or was she a danger at some point to national security, do you think, Noel?
Well, that was actually a clip there from a Press TV interview, not from just from the film itself, discussion about that film. Which, incidentally, by the way, Press TV is now back on Eutelsat just this week after being banned for a couple of years, for about 18 months. But Martin, ultimately, landmines. That's one of the things we were hearing there. Her campaign against landmines, getting them shut down right across the Western world, was causing all sorts of problems for some people.
Yes, I mean, the evidence that she may have been assassinated is definitely there. And when you've got a crime, you've got to have means, motive and opportunity. And the motive would be two motives, because she was being a bit of a nuisance to the royal family. But more importantly, she was also involved in landmines. And I understand she was also about to campaign around Palestinian issues, because she was about to marry Dodi Al-Fayed, who's a Muslim. And, for some people didn't like that.
Okay.
That's a suspicion.
Yeah, and also interesting that we can now watch this finally after, 3 years, because it's appeared on YouTube. So, time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Cyrus the Virus is up after this. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, former Bristol MP, now Labour Councillor for Avonmouth, Doug Naismith. I'm Tony Gosling. See you next week, where we'll do the World War I. Online at thisweek.org.uk.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the head of Scotland Yard's counter-terrorism unit has been moved to non-operational duties. It follows yesterday's damning report on the Stephen Lawrence murder investigation. With fresh allegations emerging about corruption, the IPCC has apologised to the teenager's parents for prolonging their search for truth. Met Commissioner Sir Bernard Hogan Howe is promising to hand over every piece of evidence to a new public inquiry.
I'm going to have somebody who independently leads a multidisciplinary team which will search right around this organisation, in every cupboard, in every computer, to find out whether we know what we've got, so I can reassure myself, and therefore the public, and the inquiries, that we're doing our best to determine this material.
Detectives have confirmed a 2-year-old girl who died in Blackpool had ingested methadone. A man and woman have been arrested over Sophie Jones's death. Oscar Pistorius's legal team have confirmed the athlete will give evidence at his trial. The final day of the first week of proceedings heard an ex-girlfriend claim he cheated on her with Reeva Steenkamp. He denies murdering the model. Our special correspondent Alex Crawford has been in court in Pretoria.
It has to be said, it's very difficult to imagine how he could defend himself without us, everyone, the court, the judge, hearing what actually happened on that night from the man himself, because at the end of the day, he is the only witness.